You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is our fourth annual Access Day. So from now till 3 p.m. Pacific Time, we will be featuring programming centered around accessibility, self-advocacy, social accessibility, adaptive programming, and more. My name is Desi Nair, and I'm from CITR's Accessibility Collective. We are broadcasting from the Musqueam Territory in Vancouver here on the West Coast. In this hour, we will be speaking to notable American disability advocate Alice Wong. Most notably, Alice is known as being the founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project, which is an online community dedicated to recording, amplifying, and sharing disability stories and culture.
Yeah, so, you know, I was always outboard disabled, so, you know, I think the experience of being disabled in a non-disabled world from the very beginning, I think in a lot of ways, you know, being an activist, you know, I think, you know, I've said this before in other conversations, but I do think, you know, just the lived experience and maybe an accidental, you know, activist, I, a lot of ways I didn't think about, I felt uncomfortable with the title, you know, the identity of being an activist for a while because, you know, I wasn't really, you know, I'm not a grassroots or, you know, community organizer. I just didn't, I was affiliated with an organization. You know, I was always kind of just, you know, working on things, you know, at a very small scale, whether it's just, you know, for myself or for others. But, you know, I think the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, you know, I do identify as an activist because I am using social media now as a real tool and platform.
Right.
To help me build community. So I guess a long story short is that, you know, I've always been an activist just because of the world that we live in and of ableism and, you know, white supremacy. But yeah, right. I think it's been an ongoing thing that's been started off as a more of an individual, you know, how do I navigate stuff for myself, to realize that there's broader systemic and institutional issues.
Right.
And system change is really where it's at, because otherwise, you know, what's the point if it helps me and it doesn't pave the way for other people? So I hope that answered your question.
That was good. That was good. So, did you have any role models growing up?
You know, I really cannot remember, especially as a young child, you know, growing up disabled in the middle of the Midwest and being, you know, being Asian American and disabled and a girl. I had nobody that ever looked like me growing up. And, you know, it wasn't until I was in college or, you know, a young adult when I started reading works by actual disabled people. And, you know, that's when I started realizing, oh my gosh, like, I'm not alone in this. And in media especially, I don't think that there were very many people that looked like me. And I think that's another thing about, you know, my friend's hashtag, by Lisa Thompson, disability to white.
Right.
I think that's a huge gap in terms of representation of all kinds of multiply marginalized disabled people because we do exist, but we just never see ourselves reflected in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. And has that changed now? Are there people that you look up to who inspire you now?
Well, I will say that, the last few years, I think Senator Tammy Duckworth is just, what a badass. I think she's just so fantastic what she does and her, her prominence, her visibility as elected official, as a mother, as a disabled woman of color. It's just really breathtaking to see that and just to see her, fully in her full self. And I think, that's like a big day, but I do think, people that I really admire are just people I've known throughout the disability community and people I follow on Twitter. I don't know if folks, a lot of people like to poo-poo Twitter, but I found it a basic way to, connect with so many diverse disabled folks, and they are so outspoken and really speak their truth. And I find a lot of people that I admire and consider role models on Twitter.
You've been doing this for a while now. You have the Disability Visibility Project. You've written for a number of publications. How do you feel yourself as someone who is admired or who people look up to? How does that feel?
Oh, geez. Well, that can be debatable, I think. It's weird when people say, I've heard of you or follow you. Sometimes I'm still kind of surprised because, I write stuff, I put stuff out there, it's just, sometimes you don't know who it reaches and who it touches, and that's very gratifying and very humbling. So I do hope that folks enjoy it and get something out of the work that I do. It's always nice to hear that. I mean, I think it's, I don't want to hold myself up as some sort of, example or be on a pedestal for anybody. Because, I just try to keep it real. Just try to keep it as real as possible.
Now, you've done quite a lot of work in terms of disability and representation in the United States. Can you tell us what kind of projects you're up to lately?
Well, I have a, I guess I like to do a lot of partnerships with people. So the last few months, I've been partnering with a disability rights media organization called Rooted in Rights. Mm-hmm. It's based in Seattle, Washington. And one of the things that, I approached them about earlier this year was to do a joint call for stories related to Me Too, mm-hmm. the Me Too movement, and the disability community.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of representation, I think the Me Too and the, Time's Up campaign,
mm-hmm.
which really blew up last year. One thing I immediately noticed was the, really the absence of disabled people and their stories in a lot of the, general coverage, the media coverage. And even for the people that are the activists and, advocates regarding sexual assault and sexual harassment, when they name all the different kind of groups who are impacted, guess what group is always left out?
Mm-hmm.
Disabled people. So, I thought, this would be a great way to kind of generate stories from our community and by our community. So, Rooted in Rights agreed to kind of put out a call, and they've published, I think, 4 to 5 guest blog posts by disabled folks related to Me Too. And we also hosted a Twitter chat this year, and another thing we have coming up on the 9th is a chat on disabled parenting. It's a lead up to Mother's Day, and I think, you know, that's another form of representation in terms of what the parent, what does parenthood look like? What does, you know, motherhood look like? And how do we center disabled parents, disabled mothers, you know, in these conversations and really using social media for to get the reach and to get the visibility and transparency out there so that all kinds of folks see it, hopefully, and to share it and amplify it.
Now, you're the founder and project coordinator of the Disability Visibility Project. Can you tell us a little bit more about it, how it came into formation?
So the Disability Visibility Project, I started it in 2014. And originally, it was just a community partnership with StoryCorps. And StoryCorps is a national voluntary nonprofit in the United States. And basically, I thought, as an individual, I thought I should record a few oral histories with my disabled friends in 2014 as a way to kind of celebrate the disability community. As in 2015, there was the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So originally it was just going to be this, you know, 1 year kind of like, you know, campaign. I thought, hey, I should try to get my friends to do it. I'll interview people that I think are amazing and just, you know, that their stories should be told. And it really blew up. It just became this really, you know, this thing that the disability community really embraced. And based on that 1 year, it seemed like, you know, a lot of people wanted to continue that. So it's been ongoing since then. And I'm really proud to say that we have over 140 oral histories.
Wow.
Ordered so far. And with our partnership with StoryCorps, the kind of really genius part of it is that they have a relationship with the Library of Congress so that participants, they have the option of archiving stories at the Library of Congress. So it feels really good that, you know, we as a community are empowered to tell our own stories and create our own histories. And we're leaving something for future generations.
Mm-hmm.
It's like pretty awesome.
That's amazing. Now, what are some things you have hoped or are still hoping to achieve with this platform?
Yeah, you know, I've kind of made it a point to kind of not to have any sort of grand plan. You know, I've really opened to different partnerships. So as the one I mentioned with Ready to Write, I really do feel like collaboration with other folks is really the most, you know, powerful, and, you know, it's a way to be, it's a really a great way to build community. So I'm really open to kind of new opportunities in the future, but I definitely would like to do more conversations, more, create more media, you know, featuring people with disabilities. And thinking one day down the road, you know, finding ways to help build skills, you know, for other disabled people who want to create their own media and don't know how to do it yet. So those are other ideas I'm kind of just trying to, you know, figure out as well.
So you're saying the Disability Visibility Project has been around for quite some time now. What have you noticed in your doing this project? Have you noticed any, what kind of changes in sentiments, maybe about disability from the general public or within the disabled communities, did you notice in your time since you've started this project?
I guess I do feel like things are a little bit better in terms of, you know, non-disabled folks noticing and appreciating disability culture, disability rights, disability justice. And I think, you know, it's really been a result of people with disabilities creating their identities and calling out on ableism, whether that's, you know, on social media or through, you know, other platforms. I do think that there are more people being proud of who they are and really unapologetic about it. And I think that to me is the, it's just something I've noticed, you know, gradually throughout the years that's really been picking up. And I think that's a really great sign. And it's, we still have a really long way to go, I think, in terms of parity and having enough, you know, I guess, power or traction. But I think, you know, it's really, it's been a slow but really encouraging sign that, you know, more people with disabilities are, like, not waiting around for other people to notice us. They're just creating and be themselves and be loud and proud. And that's great.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is our fourth annual Access Day. So from now till 3 p.m. Pacific Time, we will be featuring programming centered around accessibility, self-advocacy, social accessibility, adaptive programming, and more. My name is Desi Nair, and I'm from CITR's Accessibility Collective. We are broadcasting from the Musqueam Territory in Vancouver here on the West Coast. Stick around, don't go away. We'll be right back after the break with Alice Wong.
Skookum Festival is here, where urban meets wild in Vancouver's iconic Stanley Park, September 7th, 8th, and 9th. The Killers, Florence and the Machine, Metric, R. Kells, The War on Drugs, St. Vincent, Father John Misty, Blue Rodeo, Mother Mother, Chromeo, Bahamas, Stereophonics, and many more. Passes on sale now through SkookumFestival.com. Skookum Festival, produced by Brand Live, in collaboration with Virgin Mobile.
If you're one of the millions of Canadians who experience depression, anxiety, or some other form of mental illness, there's a free course that can help. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan is an evidence-based program that works. It's based on the key concepts of hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. The Canadian Mental Health Association is offering a free 3-day workshop specifically for family and friends. If you have a loved one who struggles with mental health challenges, this could help you maintain your wellness as a supporter. The course runs from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. April 5th, 6th, and 7th. For more information or to register, call Monica at 604-341-6356. That's 604-341-6356.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to our interview with Alice Wong, longtime disability advocate from the United States and founder of the Disability Visibility Project. You were appointed to the Presidential National Council on Disability under the Obama administration. Can you tell us what led you to the position and how was that experience being in that such a role?
There was a White House Asian American Pacific Islander committee that many years ago, they they started some sort of like storytelling spinning competition. And I submitted a video. And I think somebody at the White House saw that in the Office of Public Engagement. And I think, you know, they said, oh my gosh, Lanise, here's an Asian American disabled person talking about, you know, intersectionality in a lot of ways without, you know, using that word, but, you know, being herself. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, because of that video, I just, you know, a lot of ways I made that video just to put it out there, but I didn't even, like, you know, I didn't think anything much of it. So somebody in the White House noticed, and then they asked me if I wanted to be a member of the National Council on Disability, and yeah, I was really kind of like floored by that. But yeah, it was really a great experience. It was a 3-year term, and you know, I learned a lot in terms of policy making and, you know, talking about federal issues, and just having a small seat at a table in terms of feedback and just learning how legislation and policy works.
The Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, enacted 27 years ago, ADA is a civil rights law in the United States that prohibits discrimination based on disability. I asked Alice Wong what her thoughts were on the ADA, having grown up under the ADA, and what her thoughts were on whether or not such an act is significant.
I really do hope so. I mean, I've been following, things happening in Canada, and I'm aware of Ontario's AODA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the upcoming, you know, Federal Accessibility Act. So, you know, again, I do hope that it does happen, but, you know, one of the limitations of the ADA is that there's no enforcement or funding mechanism. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I do hope Canada learns from the ADA and add those kinds of elements to their act. Because, you know, while it's important to have a civil rights law that's federal, that any Canadian with a disability can reference, say, okay, this law protects my rights, you know, that, you know, accessibility is important and that, you know, public facilities, public spaces are obligated to accommodate me. That's incredibly important, and for any Canadian with a disability to have as a, something to claim of their, for their own. But again, you know, I do hope that, you know, this, you all are still at that kind of early stage that you build in and close the loopholes that, you know, exist with the ADA. To really make it a strong piece of legislation that really has teeth. And I think one of the things that you all are going to have to contend with, there are, you know, other stakeholders, such as business owners and other folks who will be very, very resistant to that, because, you know, social change is really tough, and a lot of people still don't understand why disability rights are part of the larger, heart of,
you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is our fourth annual Access Day. So from now till 3 p.m. Pacific Time, we will be featuring programming centered around accessibility, self-advocacy, social accessibility, adaptive programming, and more. My name is Desi Nair, and I'm from CITR's Accessibility Collective. We are broadcasting from the Musqueam Territory in Vancouver here on the West Coast. Stick around, don't go away. We'll be right back after the break with Alice Wong.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to our interview with Alice Wong, longtime disability advocate from the United States and founder of the Disability Visibility Project. So you were mentioning earlier about kind of your role in the National Council on Disability and what you learned from that. From that experience, have there been kind of lessons you've taken away from that experience in terms of initiating social change now, having been out of the role and still being politically active?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I first did my time there, and also through just, you know, different relationships with the folks over the last few years, is that, you know, I think cross-movement organizing is really where it's at. You know, I think, single issue activism is, you know, really tough. I think we've got to have coalitions of people to really understand that, you know, what impacts us, what impacts other people, and that we all have an interest in supporting one another. So, you know, I think that's a great lesson in terms of making sure that we break out of our own silos and reach out to other people and really build power that way.
So almost exactly a year ago, you wrote a powerful op-ed for the New York Times titled My Medicaid, My Life, about the effect that Medicaid, or as some people know it as Obamacare, had effect on your life. What inspired you to write this piece?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, I don't know if it's, I guess Canada, culturally it's different, but, you know, in the United States, and I know, in particular in the UK, you know, people who use people who are using safety net programs, you know, what's known as quote-unquote welfare, are incredibly demonized and they're others, you know, they're kind of lumped in, and, you know, it's part of this whole, you know, anti-poor sentiments that's really a function of, you know, capitalism in the United States. And, you know, within our recent, you know, new administration, the, you know, the outright hate toward poor people, disabled people, all kinds of marginalized communities, has really been much more explicit, you know, really ramped up. And that was really, you know, the attempt to kill the ACA is a huge, you know, threat to so many people. I mean, you know, not just people like myself, but kids, pregnant people, poor folks, older folks. So I felt the need to just share my experience of why Medicaid is a lifeline and why safety net programs like Medicaid and Medicare, which are two programs in the United States that serve millions of folks, why people who don't know much about it, who are quote-unquote good taxpayers, can't give a damn, you know, because I think that there is this sentiment that about the Rule and the Rule class and the middle class that, like, oh, those people just, you know, they're lazy. They can't help themselves. You know, they're just, you know, not trying hard enough. And you know what? That's real bullshit. You know, there's a reason why, if you want a community to be strong, you need to protect all kinds of folks. And the safety net is for everyone, you know? I think we don't realize, I think there's a denial, I think, of, you know, a lot of societies about vulnerability. You know, we're just afraid to talk about vulnerability in terms of just, not just our bodies, but really who we are as people and our right to exist. And I think that's really sad that we can't be open about our lives in a real way. You know, a small slice of kind of the realities of what I go through.
And what was some of the feedback you got from that piece, from others?
Yeah, so I read, you know, unfortunately, like, I didn't read too many comments on the New York Times, but, you know, there were a few comments of folks, because I mentioned that I worked, that I do work, and I do earn a modest income. And then there were folks who just didn't understand that, like, well, if she can work, why doesn't she get private insurance? Mm-hmm. Like, why doesn't she need to be on Medicaid? And as if they read my essay, that they would understand that, you know, personal assistance services for disabled people like myself really is not covered, not adequately covered or provided by private insurance. You know, it's really through these government-funded programs like Medicaid that really keeps people like me, you know, alive and in the community. So, you know, that to me was kind of interesting, that somehow people think, you know, you're on these welfare programs, therefore you must not, you know, therefore, like, how can you work if you're on welfare? And that's the thing, like, there are actually a lot of people who are working and receiving food stamps or housing assistance or other forms of assistance. And there's no shame in that. And I think that to me was really surprising that people felt that unusual.
Now, in your piece, you touch on changes, proposed changes that were going to be made to Medicaid under President Trump. This is a bit of a hot topic. What are your thoughts on current President Donald Trump in terms of disability justice?
Oh, boy. I guess whether he says it out loud or not, his administration has been, you know, going a full-on assault on disability rights and disability justice. I think, you know, he's been relaxing regulations on civil rights through the Department of Justice, through the Housing and Urban, through HUD, which is like the Housing and Urban Development or something. Through the Housing Cabinet, there is an administration is planning to increase the rent of people who are living in public housing. Through the Education Department, they really are supporting charter schools versus public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Really weakening the civil rights of students with disabilities. And related to Medicaid, he's allowing states to add work requirements as a condition to be on Medicaid, and this is gonna be really, you know, destructive for a lot of folks. Because while those work requirements are supposedly for able-bodied recipients, there are a lot of people with disabilities who don't fit the criteria of disabilities under these rules, and they will undoubtedly be impacted by work requirements, and so will so many other able-bodied people on Medicaid to, let's say, have caregiving duties, have caregiving responsibilities, have, you know, they may not have access to transportation or childcare. So, you know, these work requirements are going to put people at risk. And they really are going to create more instability for the poorest among us.
So what kind of shifts have you seen within disability justice spheres, this president who is making laws and is making reforms that clearly directly impact the disabled community? What kind of changing sentiments have, you know, disability justice spheres had towards fighting for disability rights?
I don't know. I mean, I think, to be honest, I think everybody's just doing what they can with what they have. And I think, you know, I do see a lot of activists, you know, really, you know, forming coalitions, really linking up with other folks, and really just trying to leverage as much as of what we have to really, you know, full on, you know, push back everything. I think it's been a really, you know, trying time, because I think for anybody who's very concerned, you know, it's been one dumpster fire after another. And I think as an activist, it's just been the danger of burning out is very real, because everything feels urgent, everything feels time sensitive, and everything feels really important. So, you know, to me, that's a real concern that I have for myself and for the people around me, because it is distressing. I think it's very distressing. I think people are scared, and people feel sometimes, you know, beaten down for a lot of reasons, for a lot of very valid reasons. So I think that's what I've seen. I've seen some amazing work and amazing solidarity. That's been the most beautiful thing, that there's solidarity about lots of folks. But I think also it's been relentless. Speaking from the U.S., it has been utterly relentless.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is our fourth annual Access Day. So from now till 3 p.m. Pacific Time, we will be featuring programming centered around accessibility, self-advocacy, social accessibility, adaptive programming, and more. My name is Desi Nair, and I'm from CITR's Accessibility Collective. We are broadcasting from the Musqueam Territory in Vancouver here on the West Coast. Stick around, don't go away. We'll be right back after the break with Alice Wong.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is
an advertisement for
Finding the Funny
on CITR 101.9 Mondays 6 to 6:30. We'd love for you to tune in and check us out on Twitter at Finding Funny FM. Every week, host Nico McEwen talks about new comedy topics, whether it be stand-up, sketch comedy, TV comedy, and more, always playing some of the most hilarious bits.
With your host, Nico McEwen.
Carry on.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to our interview with Alice Wong, longtime disability advocate from the United States and founder of the Disability Visibility Project. What are your thoughts on how disability is represented in the media world and in news coverage?
Well, I do think that, you know, representation is more than just about who's being covered, but also who's doing the storytelling. And, you know, for me, that's a real issue because, you know, part of it is power. Like, how many people in newsrooms, how many editors and reporters are out there who are disabled and are interested in covering disability issues? You know, in a lot of ways, like, sometimes how appropriate is it for non-disabled reporters to really cover disability issues in a very authentic and, you know, well-rounded way? You know, I think that's a really, you know, a good question to ask. Because I do think that in a lot of these, you know, diversity in media conversations, you know, disabled people are usually not considered part of this overall, you know, move towards diversity. So I would love to see more people who do have the privilege, who do have, you know, the opportunities and the capital, like, you know, editors and other reporters to really, you know, share those opportunities to disabled writers, whether they're reporters, journalists, you know, freelance writers, to really give them the opportunity to tell the story, because I do really feel like when it comes to the representation and how disability is framed, so much of that starts with the person who's doing the storytelling. And, you know, when it comes to journalism, that often does reside with the person who's editing and reporting. So I want to see, you know, I want to see improvements in disabled people being, you know, report, you know, features, but also I want to see more people being hired and paid to tell our stories.
So your Disability Visibility Project, now you have a Disability Visibility Project podcast. What led you to want to approach the podcast format?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it took me a while to do a podcast. I wanted to do one for a few years. But, you know, I really wanted to take my time. Because, you know, podcasting seemed very kind of intimidating to me. And also, you know, to be honest, like, I needed to save some money because, you know, I have to, like, be sure I want to do it. If I did it, I want to make sure I do transcripts. And I want to be sure that I could get, like, you know, people to help me just editing. So, you know, I set up a crowdfunding campaign. I have a Patreon page. And I launched that, I think, a year or two ago. And, you know, that was a way to really help me make sure that my media, whatever media that I create, that it's accessible. So the Disability podcast is just kind of my way of being kind of a, you know, quasi, you know, reporter of sorts, you know. It's a way to talk about current issues and really, again, just to really amplify and highlight the work of what, you know, other disabled folks are doing. So it's really like another way of doing these kind of on-street interviews, but in a different kind of format. And it's been really fun. I've just, you know, I've really enjoyed podcasting. is that I really want to get to the invisible labor that disabled people perform every day. You know, just to, just to get around, just to, live their lives. I think talking about that lived experience, talking about the invisible labor that's so unacknowledged by society, I think that to me is, one of the reasons why I did this podcast, to really just put a light to that.
Awesome. So we're just about to wrap up here. Have one more question for you. So you do so much to fight for disability justice, and you mentioned the activist burnout that you and other disability advocates often feel. In your own opinion and your own life, what keeps you going and fighting for political freedoms of the disabled community? Do you have any measures of self-care that you carry out?
Oh, absolutely. I do believe in self-care. And I do believe in indulging yourself and really try to treat yourself. I think, for myself, I love eating pastries. I love my lattes. I'm not ashamed of that. I love my lattes. So, treating myself, a donut. We don't have to. So I am very jealous of you all because I wish I had a Tim Hortons. I don't have a Tim Hortons. I hear it's fantastic. So, I try to indulge myself and I try to take breaks. I will take a few days off of being on social media because sometimes it's incredibly overwhelming. I try to make myself, do other things, focus on my friendships, on my family, on relationships outside of activism. I think, finding things that give you life, whether that's cat videos, whether that's Netflix, whether that's a giant, delicious like a cake or pie, I say go for it because life is too damn short.
Wraps up our interview with Alice Wong. Big shout out to DP Lil for her help with this interview. Thank you to Eleanor and Madeline from CITR for putting together Access Day, and of course a big thank you to our interview guest Alice Wong for speaking with us. Music is by Toki Monsta. The song is Darkest Dim. My name is Desi Nair and I'm from CITR's Accessibility Collective, and I'm signing off. Thank you everyone for listening. Stick around for some more of this amazing day of programming.
Than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change. The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival returns to Calgary from June 20th to 24th, 2018. Discover over 250 bands, comedy acts, film, and art in more than 35 venues across the city. This year's festival features guest curator Deerhoof, innovative indie rock act Dirty Projectors, electronic innovators Mount Kimby, versatile folk pop duo Way Oak, futuristic hip-hop titans Shabazz Palaces, outsider pop auteur John Mouse, and many more yet to be announced. Visit sledisland.com for details, travel deals, and to get your festival pass.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
It's been raining.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Musqueam,